Since Donald Trump declared a national emergency on March 14th, the U.S. economy is virtually in a shutdown to fight against COVID-19. How bad will it hit the U.S. economy, and how quickly can it bounce back? We spoke with David Wessel, director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution, to discuss the impact of COVID-19 on the U.S. economy. Hi, David. Thanks for joining. How are people coping with this new normal so far, being working from home and having social distancing?
Well, it doesn't feel at all normal. I've never been through anything like this. I'm 66 years old. I've lived through 9/11 and huge snowstorms and everything. Mm-hmm. But I've never been in a situation where the patriotic thing to do was to close the door to your house, stay inside, not go shopping, not see your elderly mother-in-law, not see your kids, not see your colleagues. So it's very strange. I think people who have young kids are having a really hard time working from home mm-hmm. and dealing with their young kids. And I think, of course, there are other people who are not able to work at all. Fortunately, Congress is moving to help them out. But it doesn't feel normal. And I think the most frightening thing is no one can tell us how long this is going to last. I live in Washington, D.C., and the mayor here has told us that she's banning all public events really through the end of April. So that means we could be all doing this for another 6 weeks and maybe even longer.
Yes, it's a really bad situation right now since we don't know if we have reached to the peak of the curve yet. So we just coming couple of weeks will be really critical for both America as well as Europe. So let's hope for the best.
That's correct.
Yes. The Senate just passed a $2.2 trillion stimulus package, which is the largest bailout in American history. But is it sufficient enough to rescue the economy?
Well, I think it's important to recognize what this legislation does and what it doesn't do. Mm-hmm. It does three things, I think. One, it puts some more money into our sorely underfunded public health system. Two, it helps to provide necessary assistance to people and businesses that have been ordered by the government to shut down. And third, it keeps parts of the economy on life support so that when the virus does recede, the economy can restart again with vigor. I doubt that it'll be enough to prevent a very deep recession. It may make it slightly milder, and it may make the recovery better. I think there's widespread expectation that Congress will probably have to appropriate more money as they see where the needs are. State and local governments, for instance, are going to be particularly hard hit. Their revenues are going to go down and their spending is going to go up, and there's not enough money in here to compensate them. So there's probably more to come, but this is pretty heroic to do this kind of a huge package with lots of moving parts and a number of really interesting experiments in a short period of time in a system where Congress has lately been moving very slowly. As you may know, the bill passed the Senate 96-0. I don't think that before this, the Congress could agree on what the day of the week was, 96-0.
But what about low or middle income families? They probably being hit the hardest by the coronavirus and the shutdown of the economy. Is it enough to help them out?
I think it's quite a bit. They're going to send checks to every household under a certain income. That's interesting to see how long it takes it out. But it'll be $2,400 for joint tax return to couples that make under $150,000 U.S., and another $100 for each of the kids. And secondly, we have what will develop is in some European countries of unemployment insurance. What the government has said is that they're going to increase the amount of benefits that people get who aren't working and broaden the set of people who are eligible for them. And in addition, they're making loans to small businesses, and they're telling the businesses, if you keep the workers on your payroll with the money we're giving you, you won't have to pay back the loans. So I think there is quite a bit to help low-income people. I think there are other things they could have done that they didn't. And I think the big question now is how quickly can they actually get the money out? We're a big country. We're not used to doing things like this.
So in your view, how quickly can those families start receiving the money?
I don't really know. I think it's a matter of weeks. I think what people are hoping is if you're a restaurant that's closed or mm-hmm. cut your staff in half and you agreed to pay your workers for a couple of weeks, if you know the money's coming from the government to reimburse you for paying your salaries, maybe you'll keep them on. I think there's a lot of administrative things I don't fully understand. Can you do this on direct deposit to bank accounts if the people have given that information to the government? Could you use debit cards to increase public benefits that are provided on veterans? So we don't really know. But they're asking a huge amount of the government bureaucracy. And this would be difficult to do in good times. But as you know, a lot of people are forced to work from home, including some of the people who are responsible for getting out the checks like this. So it's going to be very hard.
This bill will certainly lessen the economic pain, but you can't really revive the economy yet when it's still in a shutdown. So to what extent, in your view, has COVID-19 affected the U.S. economy?
It's been an unprecedented effect on the U.S. economy. We have literally slammed the brakes on much of the U.S. economy. We're very much a service economy here. Most of what our economic activity is services, not manufacturing. And so it's just, we've never seen anything like this. The expectations are that the output of the U.S. economy in the second quarter, that's April, May, and June, mm-hmm. will be maybe 5 to 10% less than in the first quarter. And the way we've expressed things in the U.S. is as an annual decline in GDP at an annual rate. That's the kind of thing we haven't seen since the Great Depression. But the really difficult thing to know is how long do we have to stay locked down before it's safe? Obviously, we can't stay locked down until every bit of the virus is gone. As you may have seen, there's a bit of an argument between President Trump and the public health experts.
Yes.
He would like to get back to business soon. And the public health experts are saying that's not a good idea. And in part, the problem is that if a lot of people get sick all at once, the hospitals will be overwhelmed. We're already seeing that in New York City. And I think that's a huge problem. People are going to die. But it's also very uncomfortable for Americans. We're used to thinking we're good at everything, better than the rest of the world. And when we see overcrowded emergency rooms, or there's a picture in the New York Post today of healthcare workers wearing garbage bags because they're out of protective gear, it's very unsettling to people, and I think that that's going to undermine confidence in the government, and that's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, this is certainly a really unprecedented and challenging time. What about the long-term economic impact? Has this virus caused any long-lasting structural damage to the U.S. economy?
We don't really know. I think a lot of what the government is doing and the Federal Reserve is doing is trying to limit the long-run damage to the economy. We know that if a lot of businesses go bankrupt, sure, new businesses will sprout up to take their place, but it takes a while for that to happen. You have to organize business and suppliers. So part of the goal of what's going on now is to keep these businesses on life support so they can be revived. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it will have some lasting damage. It will change some things in ways that we find very hard to predict. For example, is a therapist for young children, and for the first time, she's now doing therapy with children remotely over their computer. So that's a big deal. And ways it'll change this stuff. I hope that what it'll also do is teach us that the public health experts who were quite worried about pandemic or were largely ignored will mm-hmm. be listened to, and we'll build more resilience. So for the next time one of these things happens, we'll have more temporary hospital beds and stuff like that.
Yeah, then this leads to my next question, which is it going to be a V-shape, U-shape, or L-shape scenario in terms of economic recovery? History revealed that used to be a V-shape or a quick economic recovery from previous epidemics or pandemics, for example, SARS in 2003, the H3N2 flu in 1968, and the H2N2 flu in 1958.
Well, the short answer is we don't really know. I think we know that some of those previous episodes are different because the virus wasn't as contagious or as deadly, and the world wasn't quite as connected. So, you know, it's really remarkable. 10 years ago, people like me who wrote about the economy were consulting the history books to understand the Great Depression. Today, we're consulting the history books to look at what happened in the influenza epidemic of 1918. It's a little hard to draw lessons because it coincided with World War I, which is kind of a big event. Mm-hmm. I think the short answer to your question is it really depends on what happens on the virus. If we manage, as they say, to flatten the curve, if it looks like the number of incidents of coronavirus have peaked and start to come down, it'll be easier to restart the economy. But until we know what's happening on the public health side, it's very hard to predict what's happening on the economy side. It is true that after natural disasters like hurricanes or snowstorms, or even after 9/11, there was a period of time when there wasn't much economic activity, and then there was a surge afterwards. And I think the optimists are hoping that'll happen, and it'll happen in the second half of the year. But I don't trust economists, even smart ones, to tell what's going to happen to the economy unless they can first tell me what's going to happen to the virus and the spread of the virus, and they're just making assumptions.
Even before the COVID-19 pandemic hit the U.S., many economists have been speculating that the country might be heading for a recession, since the U.S. economy has been experiencing the longest economic expansion since World War II. Do you think that a recession will still hit in 2020 without COVID-19?
I do not. First of all, expansions do not die of old age. Something has to murder them. And there was nothing in the U.S. economy that led me to believe that this expansion was going to end abruptly. There was some speculation last year that a recession was on the horizon, but the strength of the labor market, the strength of consumer spending, and the fact that interest rates were going to be low for a long time, I think probably would have sustained the economy. We'll never know, of course. But, you know, the Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell went on national TV Thursday morning in the U.S. on the Today Show, mm-hmm. and he made the point that the economy was strong before this, and that suggests that we'll be in better shape to recover when this virus recedes. We're not starting. In contrast, in Europe, the economy was in lousy shape before this, and this is just making things worse. The U.S. was in very good shape, and this is bad, but maybe we'll have the vigor to recover. At least that's the hope.
Let's hope that it's going to be a V-shaped recovery. The global economy is in free fall, and the U.S. economy is in a de facto shutdown. The U.S. government has employed both fiscal and monetary policy tools to save the world's biggest economy. The Fed has just launched unlimited QE, pumping a limited amount of money into the economy. But unlike any previous recessions, this economy is crippled by both demand and supply shock. People remain at home. Restaurants, bars, shopping malls are closed in order to flatten the curve. Many people have been laid off already. How can the government boost up consumption when consumer confidence is dropping dramatically?
Well, it's a good question, and it's very hard to do. I think what the government is trying to do is two things. One is make sure that people who don't have income have money to pay the rent, pay the light bill, buy food, and whatever else their necessities while they're at home. And then the second thing what they're trying to do is make sure that when this is passed, people have money in their pockets or jobs to go to so that the recovery can be stronger. So a lot of what we're doing now is putting things into the economy that won't really pay off in consumer spending until a month or two after the virus recedes. I think you raise another question, though, which is important. As you correctly point out, this is a global phenomenon. It started in China. Mm-hmm. It's been terrible in Italy and Spain. And I am concerned that international cooperation and coordination, which is so important in these crises, as we've seen in the past, has been weakened by the nationalism and the trade tensions of all parts of all people during this thing. So I think the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Health Organization are trying very hard to get global leaders who don't like each other to cooperate and figure out what to do here. But we don't start from a very good place, in part because of the America First policies of President Trump.
Yes, given the rising U.S.-China tension, it's hard to come together and work on this global issue at the moment.
I think also that it's unfortunate that while this may be the right thing to do, having everybody close their borders just makes it all the harder. And I think that we have to be really careful that we don't fall prey to the idea that this was, this is the result of globalization and immigration and stuff like that. And there's a bit of that feel in the United States now, which is a problem. And that will hurt the world economy going forward. If we can't restart the global economy, have trade in goods and services and migration of people, again, we will not grow as fast as we might have otherwise.
As you just pointed out earlier, that many countries have closed down their borders. Well, is there any long-term implications on the global economy since the anti-immigrants or protectionist sentiments is on the rise? Could this be a tipping point to decouple the global markets? And it's going to be a really terrible, terrible news for the world economy. This is something that happened previously, that which led to the Great Depression and Second World War.
Well, I think we reached the tipping point before the COVID virus. The trade war between the United States and China, for instance, and the difficulties in having the functioning of the World Trade Organization. So I think that we were already rethinking globalization. I think that global elites in Asia, Europe, and the United States have woken up to the fact that there are a lot of people in their countries who haven't benefited from globalization and technological change. They're very angry. And in countries that have elections, they vote, and they voted in populist and often anti-globalist globalization leaders. And so I think even before this, there was a need to figure out how do we make sure that the benefits of trade and immigration, which I believe are huge, are more widely shared than they have been in the future. Aging societies like the United States, Europe, and Japan are going to suffer if they close the door to immigrants. And I think that that's widely understood among experts and widely disbelieved among ordinary working people who feel like they've been hurt. I think that the underlying a lot of this anxiety, which is just magnified by what's going on now, is this widening inequality between winners and losers in the economy. That was true before this. You know, the wages of people at the top were rising faster than the wages of people at the middle and so forth. But in a situation like this, I'm drawing my paycheck, I'm working at home, but someone who works in a gas station 2 miles from my house may be laid off and not be getting paid. In school systems that are trying to turn from in-person classes to online education, you have to deal with the fact that not everybody has a laptop at home or Wi-Fi. In the outside of Washington in suburban Montgomery County, the school system is giving Chromebooks to families that don't have computers so their kids can learn. So we have to be careful that we don't exacerbate the haves versus the have-nots phenomena which preceded the COVID virus. And I think this is bringing out some of those tensions.
Let me switch back to monetary policy. With short-term interest rates near zero coupled with unlimited money supply by the Fed, what are the implications for the financial markets, both in the United States and in the emerging economies?
Well, there is a risk that if there's too much money printed by the Fed, that we will have too much demand for the crippled supply and we'll end up with more inflation than we want. Mm-hmm. I think that's a price worth paying, but that's one possibility here, that after years and years of having inflation that is lower than central bank targets, we'll have ones that will have inflation that is higher. I think that a second issue, and this is particularly hard for emerging markets, is that to the extent that the dollar is strong because people are looking for the safety of the U.S. dollar, it'll have all sorts of problems for emerging markets that have borrowed, corporates there or governments that have borrowed in dollars. It'll make it hard for them to pay back. There'll be flows of money out of emerging markets to the U.S. or whatever. I think that's going to be unsettling, and I recognize that some countries are better equipped than others to cope with these shocks. So I think it's going to be a problem, and a number of my colleagues at the Brookings Institution who focus on emerging markets are particularly concerned that some emerging markets will be hit very hard, in part because their public health systems aren't as strong as those in the U.S. and Europe, and those are really overstretched, but in part because they may find that global investors just give up on them and put their money in safer places.
I mean, even before the COVID-19 pandemic, many countries, for example, Japan and Europe, their interest rates are below zero, and we were anticipating the U.S. interest rates will be lower as well. And that,
right.
that it's good for businesses who need to loan money, but what about the implications for the estate market? Is that going to lead to asset bubble, or is it going to be a pension fund crisis in the future?
I think that there are two different things here. One is lowering interest rates at a time of crisis like this is what you have to do, and you may have to pay costs in the future, but the costs of not doing it are greater. So that's different. But the other thing that's going on, as you're pointing out, is that for the last, 30 or 40 years, the level of interest rates around the world has been coming down. One way to understand that is there's a lot of savings, a lot of in government and corporate and public hands and private hands, and there's not an increase in investment. So this global savings glut, as my colleague Ben Bernanke puts it, has depressed interest rates, and that does cause problems. And we're going to have to learn to live with those. I think what COVID-19 does is suggest that interest rates will be lower for even longer than we had expected. It's hard for pension funds in a way because their returns will not be as great. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's good for borrowers. It's anybody who borrows is benefiting from this. I mean, one of the reasons the U.S. government can spend $2 trillion is that people are willing to lend the U.S. Treasury money for 10 years at less than 1%. So that's one of the reasons why we can afford to do this. On the other hand, it's bad. First, it's good for, in short, it's good for borrowers, it's bad for savers, and it's a symptom of a real malaise in the world economy that there's not more demand for in savings to invest in the future. And that's a worrisome problem that precedes this. We'll have to see whether this makes it worse or whether when we come out of this, there'll be this big surge of investment.
Mm-hmm. Even though the overall U.S. economy is suffering tremendous pain from the outbreak of COVID-19, some sectors are doing incredibly well, like e-commerce. Amazon just recently announced that it will hire additional 100,000 workers amid a surge of online orders. Tech sectors experience a major boom in demand as service-oriented companies rely on using virtual meeting software. Do you think the current economic slowdown will be as bad as the Great Recession or even worse?
Well, first of all, yes, there's some winners in this, as you point out. Anybody who delivers to houses like Amazon or UPS and companies that provide software to allow us to have virtual meetings, those mm-hmm. companies are going to benefit. And we've seen a number of retailers adding workers and in some cases paying bonuses or hazard pay. So that's good. It's not nearly enough to offset all the people who are laid off by airlines and railroads and so forth. I lost track of the second part of your question.
Do you think the current economic slowdown will be as bad as the Great Recession or
no.
even worse?
I think it could be worse than the Great Recession, but we don't really know yet. A lot of that depends on what happens to the virus. I think what we've learned a couple of things in the Great Recession that we are taking advantage of today. So the Great Recession was largely a financial system shock caused by a bursting housing bubble that infected the overall economy. This time it's the other way around. The problem starts in the real economy. And I think what the Federal Reserve and others are doing is trying to make sure that the financial system doesn't amplify that shock. And fortunately, we came into this with the banks in pretty good shape in the U.S., and the Federal Reserve has a playbook that was left from the Great Recession that they are following now to keep credit flowing in the economy. So I think the problems will be different. But in the Great Recession, we didn't tell everybody to stay home and stop shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is so unusual, it's really hard to know. For sure, the second quarter, the April, May, June quarter, will be worse than any quarter we saw during the Great Recession. And there are forecasts that say that the unemployment rate will rise above 10%, which was the peak in the Great Recession. If we're lucky, though, the recovery will be stronger and less painful than it was than the recovery that followed the recession.
There are over 60,000 confirmed cases in the U.S. Although getting tested is now free, the cost for treatment is very expensive even if you have medical insurance. For patients without complications, the average price tag for treatment is almost $10,000. That's for patients who have medical insurance. What would be the long-term implications for household debts?
Well, that's a good question. Unfortunately, we haven't figured out how to run a healthcare system that is fair and equitable in the United States, although we've done a lot better in recent years. I think that eventually Congress will make it possible for everybody who needs to get treated to get treated at a reasonable cost, in part because if a poor person gets sick and isn't treated, that could spread to a rich person. So rich people have an interest in making sure that poor people get treated. I think that household debt wasn't that bad before the Great Recession. There will be some borrowing now. There's all sorts of things the governments are doing to make it easier for people to suspend payments on their mortgages and their student loans so that they don't get into trouble. So I don't think that's not my big worry. Household debt is my big worry. A bigger problem is there are a lot of companies that are kind of financially fragile before this that have borrowed a lot of money that aren't going to be able to pay it back. And that may ricochet through the economy, through the mutual funds and insurance companies and pension funds and others that have bought them.
Especially the small, medium-sized companies, because they account for 44% of the U.S. economy.
Right. That's why there's a lot of money in this bill coming from Congress to give loans, forgivable loans to small business. It's going to be hard because we're not very efficient at lending to small business. It's a lot easier to lend money to 500 big companies than millions of small companies. So some small businesses are going to fail. There's no doubt about it. There's nothing we can do to bring that number to zero. I think we're trying to limit the number and trying to keep as many of them as live as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, David. I hope this virus scare will soon go away and everything will get back to normal. Please stay safe, and we're all thinking about you
guys
in Hong Kong.
Okay, thank you very much for thinking about me.